Coming up.
Today we honour the Indigenous peoples of this land.
Should you feel guilty about a wrong committed by someone else in your family?
What about an ancestor you never even knew?
We apologise for the mistreatment of those who were stolen generations. This blemished chapter in our national history. How can we dance when our earth is burning?
How do we sleep while our beds are burning? Why should I feel guilty for the wrongs my great-grandfather committed against your great-grandfather?
There's a power in acknowledging a mistake so that together we can continue to perfect our union.
Aren't I responsible only for myself and myself alone?
Our guest is Larry May from Vanderbilt University.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin over at Stanford University, where Ken and I hang around Philosopher's Corner.
Today, we're discussing moral taint and collective responsibility as we ask, can we be tainted by the sins of our fathers?
Of course we can, and of our mothers, too. Adam and Eve ate that apple, remember, and tainted all of humankind with original sin.
Yeah, you know, John, but I know that's the biblical theory, but frankly, I don't get it. I never have gotten it. They ate the apple, not us. Why does God hold us responsible for what they did?
Well, it's not just the Bible and the somewhat impenetrable mind of God. It's also the law, Ken. A parent allows his underage kid to drive the car. The kid gets in a crash and injures some people. Whom do you think they're going to sue?
Well, but underage children, that's a special case, John. I get that one. Special case, though.
Okay, you're an employer. One of your managers barters promotions for sexual favors. You, as his employer, can be sued for his actions.
Well, that's another special case. The law regards managers as agents of their employers. Well, when somebody else is directly acting as my agent on my authority, sure, I can be held responsible for what they do. But so what about that? That doesn't mean anything.
So what? So your simple-minded principle is slowly getting whittled down to nothing?
Well, no, I disagree. We talked about a few special cases, but otherwise, it's pretty straightforward. A person cannot, should not be held responsible for anybody's actions except his or her own.
Well, what about this? Your country invades some faraway land, seizes their oil fields, and installs a puppet government to do its bidding. Given that hypothetical, how would you feel?
Well, I'd be pretty outraged. I know what you're thinking about. I'd be outraged. I'd also frankly be ashamed of my country.
Aha, ashamed. Would you feel ashamed if it were Russia doing the invading?
Well, I'd still strongly disapprove, that's for sure. No doubt about it. But ashamed? No, I wouldn't feel ashamed. That seems inappropriate somehow.
Yeah, because you're not a Russian. So you bear no responsibility whatsoever for what Russia does.
I bear no responsibility whatsoever for what the U.S. does, John.
Well, and who does?
Well, the people who determine and carry out its policies. That's who.
Well, how about ordinary citizens who condone and support its policies?
Well, yeah, okay, maybe them too, maybe, at least to a certain extent, I grant you that.
How about people who are secretly disapprove of the policies, but are too afraid or lazy to openly resist?
Gee, gosh, to some extent, I want to hold them responsible, but even they are only responsible for what they themselves actually did or didn't do. Their failure to speak up when they might have. That doesn't make them responsible for the crimes that their nation ended up committing. So my principle still holds. You're only responsible for what you yourself do.
Well, I'm not so sure. Even if there's nothing that a person actually does or fails to do, I think they can still bear some degree of responsibility.
I don't see how. You're just making that up.
Well, here's another hypothetical. Suppose that for several centuries, my ancestors held your ancestors in slavery. Mine got richer and richer. Yours got poorer and poorer. One day the slaves are finally freed, but for decades, maybe even centuries after, the descendants of the slaves are much worse off than the descendants of the slaveholders.
You think that just because you benefited from that sorry history and I was harmed by that history, you and your brethren owe reparations. That's what you think to me and my brethren, even if you guys aren't actively oppressing us guys anymore. Is that what you think?
Well, I'm not exactly saying I want to pay you reparations, Ken, but I'm not so sure it wouldn't be a just thing to do. I'm just saying that the issue's a lot more complicated than you were first making it out to be.
You know, John, I see that there's definitely a lot to think about here.
Well, to give us even more food for thought, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Natalie Jones, to take a look at the reparations movement in America. She files this report.
A few months ago, the African-American reparations movement got a huge public boost. The Atlantic magazine ran a cover story called The Case for Reparations.
Anytime you say the word reparations, people think you're talking about people who are long dead. But in fact, they're people who are alive, who have been disadvantaged and injured by policies that were done in our name.
That's Atlantic writer Ta-Nehisi Coates on the Colbert Report. Most of his Atlantic article refers to what happened after slavery and in the not-so-distant past. Lynchings, Jim Crow laws, housing discrimination, and predatory lending. But even if some victims are still around, could reparations do anything to repair the damage? William Darity, economics professor at Duke University, believes they could.
It's partially a symbolic indication that the nation has met an obligation or a debt to a community that's been subjected to deep injustice for many, many years. But also it can provide an opportunity for trying to close the kinds of gaps or disparities that exist between blacks and the rest of the American population.
Darity says any eventual reparations program would have to be an act of Congress, which means there would have to be significant buy-in from the American public. So theoretically, it wouldn't create much resentment. But it also would not solve everything.
Do I think it would change racial attitudes across the entire population? No. But it would give the recipients of reparations an opportunity to, in some sense, purchase their way around the obstacles that might be created by those attitudes, an opportunity that they don't possess at the moment.
Why are so many people who are brown and black poor? Is it because they're stupid? No. There's no evidence for that.
Robin Kelly teaches history at UCLA.
What there is evidence for is a continuation, the perpetuation of structures of racial inequality that keep each generation in the same place.
For years, Kelly's publicly supported a reparations movement. In his opinion, the key word is movement.
The point is that the money wouldn't go to individual families to enrich them, but to create institutions that were cooperatively run, organize and envision for the purpose of liberation.
He says an ideal reparations program would benefit Americans of all races by improving education, healthcare, and social institutions.
And that's a very different idea from like 40 acres and a Lexus, you know, in the way that people sort of joke about reparations.
According to Professor Kelly, an effective program could go even further.
Once you raise the question of reparations, you also interrogate the entire system of wealth creation. And when you do that, then it forces you to rethink the whole system that exists today.
But even if you accept the idea of reparations, there are still a lot of questions, like who pays and how much.
There is an orbit of white privilege and an orbit of substantial black disadvantage that exists today.
Again, Duke Professor William Darity.
So even if individuals did not directly suffer the consequences of a phenomenon like slavery, they are experiencing the advantages and disadvantages that were produced by those conditions.
U.S. reparations are not a new idea. In the 80s and 90s, the government paid reparations to Japanese Americans put in internment camps during World War II. But that was a much smaller group, around 80,000. And reparations were only available to people who were imprisoned themselves, not their descendants. The scope and complexity of reparations to blacks makes it even more of a controversial issue.
Japanese Americans are not the same flashpoint for antagonism that black Americans are.
It's a tough conversation that raises tough questions about privilege and responsibility. But as Atlantic writer Ta-Nehisi Coates says,
"Oh, I think it's our history, and I do think it's necessary to bum people out sometimes to heal people."
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.
Thanks, Natalie, for bringing us up to date on reparations. I'm John Perry, and with me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're asking about being tainted by the sins of our fathers. We're joined now by Larry May. He's a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. He's author of many things, including Sharing Responsibility. Larry, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be there.
Larry, the question of moral taint is a nice philosophical question, and it's one with real-world significance, and it's a very difficult one. Now, there's all kinds of philosophical topics. What drew you to this one? Was it pure philosophy or something about your life? How'd you get interested in moral taint and collective responsibility?
Well, my interest in all this goes back to the days when I was a teenager during the Vietnam War. And I found myself feeling ashamed for what my country had done. This is similar to what John said earlier. And this was despite the fact that I had not done anything to bring about the Vietnam War. And in fact, I'd spent as much time as I could protesting. So I thought that was something that I couldn't understand. And so somewhat like Ken in his earlier remarks, I thought I shouldn't have this feeling. But then I also came to realize that I took pride when, you know, the U.S. did something that I approved of. And so the shame that I felt was a sort of flip side of the pride, and I had to take account of both of these. And so when I got a chance to think about these things in more detailed ways, it was one of the first topics that I glommed onto.
Well, I share a lot of those memories of the Vietnam War with you, although I was a little bit older, but I had very similar feelings. Ken started out believing, or at least pretending to believe, that we can only be held responsible for what we ourselves do. And I talked him out of that belief. But, you know, you got to admit there's got to be some limits. I mean, can you suggest a principle that determines to what extent we can be held responsible or can legitimately feel guilty or proud for someone else's actions?
Well, I think there are a couple of principles, but I'll just start with one. I mean, one is just to realize that our lives are interconnected in ways we hardly imagine, and that we facilitate what others do in many ways that I think would make us responsible. And so one way I think to get into this topic is to think about not just what we've done directly, but what we may have done indirectly in these various ways that we could have been complicit in what others have done. And so I think you need to think about omissions, and you need to think about a lot of other things like that. Now, the question is whether you have the same degree of responsibility as you move further and further away. And I would agree with Ken that as you move further from being directly responsible, then the degree of responsibility gets less and less.
So, Larry, but that's really interesting. So, look, I mean, if I'm a part of an endeavor, and the endeavor goes badly, I mean, if I'm legitimately, you know, a participant in the endeavor, sure, I can be held responsible. That makes sense to me. But how much responsibility, given, you know, if I just work in the factory that makes the bombs that the government uses to blow up the cities of the innocent civilians, huh? Do I bear some responsibility?
Well, see, this is where I tried to bring into the discussion a few years ago when I wrote about these issues. The idea of taint. So I think the question is, what should you feel or how should you regard yourself? And I think that we should bring back this ancient Greek notion of being tainted or polluted, which wasn't nearly as strong as being guilty or even as feeling being ashamed at something. So I think that as you move further and further out in this domain, especially in the case that you folks are especially concerned about today, about the sins of your grandparents or something, the idea of taint, I think, is especially a good one to think about because it isn't the same as guilt. It's feeling somewhat responsible, but not to the point where you feel that you're blameworthy and certainly not to the point of feeling that you should be punished.
Well, that's an interesting notion, this notion of taint, because as you say, I just want to underline what you said because I think it's really important. Being morally tainted by some action isn't the same as being guilty for it, right? So I may not be guilty for the crimes of my country, but because I'm a participant in some way, I may be tainted by the sins of my country, say. Is that kind of
what you... Yeah, so you can... Yeah, so think about Oedipus, for instance, right? Oedipus sleeps with his mother and kills his father. And he's done these things. There's no question about it. But, of course, he didn't know that the person that he killed was his father, and he didn't know that the woman he slept with was his mother. And so, nonetheless, according to Sophocles and according to Greek tradition, he's thought of as polluted or tainted by what he's done, and he has to do something in order to purify himself. But that's a very different kind of thing than if he had intentionally done something so that we could hold him responsible in a court, or so you could even hold him responsible in, you know, the public, where you would think that he's to be blamed.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing moral taint and collective responsibility as we ask, can we be tainted by the sins of our fathers or our mothers? Our guest is Larry May from Vanderbilt University.
Should we feel responsible for the actions of our nation or of our children or of our ancestors? Clearly, many people do, but why should we feel this way? After all, our ancestors aren't us and we aren't them. And where does it end? Should I really feel responsible for wrongs committed way before I was born, even if I'm a beneficiary of these wrongs?
Exploring the extent and limits of our collective responsibility when Philosophy Talk continues.
The cavalry's charged. The Indians died. Oh, the country was young with God on its side.
Are we necessarily tainted by the sins of a young country that thought it had God on its side? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and today we're asking, can we really be tainted by the sins of our fathers?
Can't I just wash my hands of the wrongs done by others? Can't I just disown the wrongs done by my children, my ancestors, my countrymen, even my employers? Employees, I should say? Or is there something about our relationship that makes their actions impact my own guilt or innocence? Our guest is Larry May from Vanderbilt University. He's the author of Sharing Responsibility.
So, Larry, I get two things. I get that I sometimes act on my own. I sometimes act as part of a group, either majorly or minorly. It makes perfect sense to me that I can be held either wholly or partly or a little bit responsible. But here's the thing I don't really get. I want you to think about this collection to the past. You know, all Americans are inheritors of the benefits that we accrue by having done all that wrong to the Native Americans. I mean, but, you know, we played no part in that action at all. We didn't cooperate in it. So what's the principle that holds us to some degree, any degree, responsible? I don't quite get the principle, and I don't see how it could be a limited thing.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about causal connections, where you were either directly or indirectly connected. And now there, on my view, there's also a connection in terms of whether you benefited or not. Now, the benefit often is hard to establish, and it's hard to figure out what you might owe. So think about the example of, you have your grandfather's watch, and you have no idea what its history was, but it turns out somebody makes you aware that your grandfather had stolen it from my grandfather several generations ago. Now, here's the problem. Should we upset your seemingly just title to the watch at this stage and make you give it back to him,
he's dead,
because
right?
because he's dead, and so there's only you and me at this stage. So who's going to be the beneficiary? And so one of the things that happens in American law is that they feel that we should only go back a certain number of generations, normally only two, because of the havoc that it would create on just titles or otherwise just titles. So when you think about this in policy terms, you've got to think about what the benefits and risks are of changes in policies or changes in ownership claims like this.
But law, so sorry to interrupt you, but law is a complicated thing that's partly morality, partly politics, partly, you know, kind of cost-benefit compromises and all that stuff by the stakeholders. I think about pure, if we can for a second, pure morality. I mean, do the living Native Americans have some moral claim against all of us other Americans who are the inheritors of this land from which they were dispossessed?
Before we move to that, Ken, what would you do with this watch that you own that's really your grandfather stole from Larry's grandfather? Would you feel tainted? Guilty?
I would think there's an ugly history there. But here's the thing about history. You can't really rewind it. It's a really ugly history. Once I know this ugly history, I'd say, oh, goodness, what an ugly history. But I don't see why Larry has any particular claim on it anymore, morally. I don't know.
So when was it extinguished, I guess, is the question.
Well, I mean, my grandfather didn't have any right to steal it from you, your grandfather. I grant you that. But we're new people, right? And I got it by some lottery. Here's the lottery of life, right? I have a grandfather who stole something from your grandfather, and the lottery of life, which, you know, and it starts when we're born, gave me this thing that he illegitimately possessed. But that's just the lottery.
So how would you feel if you would have done the same thing that your grandfather did?
Like
what if
schmuck?
We can figure out? What if we can figure out that you would be in exactly the same position? But for the good luck of having been born two generations later. Does it matter to you that you have the same dispositions, that you would have acted in exactly the same way as your grandfather did, in terms of figuring out what to think about this morally?
I would feel like, I mean, the way you're making me, my grandfather was a schmuck. He's the one who stole it, right? And if I had those same dispositions, I would be a schmuck too.
So what if your father, who had the watch in between your grandfather and you, took out a mortgage based on the value of the watch and bought the farm that you still operate? And Larry might have had a farm if it hadn't been for that.
Yeah. So I don't know. What about it, Larry? I don't pretend to have any answers here. I think this is complicated. I grant you this is complicated stuff. The beginning of our lives is a complicated lottery. And sometimes we win the lottery and sometimes we lose the lottery.
Yeah.
And I believe in justice, and I believe maybe we should rewind the lottery and reorder the things and try to minimize the effects of life's lottery. I'm just not sure it's helpful to think in terms of it, of me compensating you for the wrongs my grandfather did to your grandfather. Just think in terms of pure distributive justice and how we deal with the lottery of life.
I thought you didn't have any answers.
Well, I just proposed one.
So one way to go, I think, is to not think about this on the individual level, but to think about it collectively. And then maybe some of your worries are made less so. So most of the reparations plans are not about forcing an individual to give something to another individual, but they're rather collective schemes of just redistribution that I think are not quite as fraught. But I do think that there's a interesting and very important problem, and that is something that actually Thomas Jefferson spoke about at one point when he talked about the fear of incessant responsibility. And I take it that's what's motivating Ken's worries, and I agree with some of that for sure. The question is whether we can come up with a principle, whether we can come up with a series of examples that will make folks see, that responsibility should be extended into certain domains when they otherwise wouldn't have thought so.
So do you have a principle? I see the worry that the fear. That's a lovely phrase. Can you repeat that phrase? The fear of incessant responsibility.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's a lovely phrase. So you have a principle in mind that would help us still.
Well, as I say, I think that I've suggested in my writings that there isn't a single principle, but we look to various ways in which we may be interconnected with others through our omissions, through our participating in joint ventures, through benefiting from something that someone else lost from. And then I think that there's this other sort of principle that if you would have done the same but for your good luck, then there's a sense in which you're also responsible. And so I do think that that helps to explain some of these multi-generational issues. So I think that when a current German expresses some kind of perhaps felt guilt or moral taint or whatever for what his grandfather or great-grandfather did in the Nazi period, I think it's often a worry that he might have done the same thing, that if he was in a pressured situation where he was trying to fend for his family and so forth, that he might very well have done the same thing. And that's one of the things that connects them. It's not just causal connections or omissions or even benefiting. It may be just this matter of whether you can see that you would have done something different.
Yeah, I see your point. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about moral taint and collective responsibility. Can we be tainted by the sins of our forebears? And Gerald from Palos Verdes is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gerald.
Hello. You've addressed the issue of tangible benefit, but I was thinking that it makes perfect sense to feel no sort of responsibility or taint from bad acts your ancestors or your nation did if you never feel any pride or pleasure in what they did.
Yeah,
before you were born.
Good question, Gerald. Are you done? Sorry.
And I think that's impossible for maybe all but sociopaths.
Ah.
So given that you will feel proud to be a member, a citizen of the nation that has done a lot to extend freedom, you should also feel some unpleasantness or maybe situational guilt as opposed to causal guilt, like in Christian justification, where you're situationally righteous, but you're not really. Given that we're human, I mean, it's not a complete lottery. You're not just a random personality that got slotted into your body this morning. You are who you are partially because your grandfather was who your grandfather was.
I like that phrase too, Gerald. Thanks for that.
Really nice question, Gerald. So, Larry, what do you think? What do you want to say in response?
Well, I'm on Gerald's side on this, I guess. I think that's right, that it's nearly impossible for us to disconnect ourselves from all of the various groups that influenced us and that we're members of. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to think that we're not responsible at all. Now, I do think, though, that Gerald is also right to say that it may be that we're in a different domain morally than if there was some direct causal connection. So this is why I think we need to cut this differently. A lot of people, I think, have trouble with these questions about reparations and whatever because they think that we must be thinking of guilt and perhaps even punishment down the road.
Mm-hmm.
My view is that we're not in that domain when we're thinking often about these questions about multi-generational reparations, but rather we need some category that will allow us to mark something that people really do feel about these matters and is still, I think, fully within the moral domain. And that's what the idea of moral taint for me is all about.
Well, I like your idea of moral taint, and I like the distinction you make in some of your writings, at least, that people focus on kind of the paradigm case of individual moral responsibility where there's desert and justice demands punishment and so forth and so on. And I think as soon as you talk about collective responsibility, shared responsibility, you're automatically extending that category to actions of others. But it seems to me that you and Gerald are both right. It's just human nature and not irrational to feel some sense of responsibility. Maybe taint's a great word for it. For example, you mentioned the Vietnam War, and then when we invaded Iraq, I thought, God, I'm living through this again, this fog of Washington where they think they can solve the Indochina problems or the Shiite-Sunni problems. I don't feel individual responsibility for it, but I do feel guilty. I feel somehow I should be devoting my life to doing something to change this bad habit of Americans. And that's not irrational. It's not irrational to have a system where you feel differently about systems you're part of and can influence, is it?
But let me put the question to both you and Larry, just following up on that, John. I can hear Osama bin Laden saying, well, yes, exactly right, John. You are an inescapable part of this. You cannot wash your hands of Americans. Therefore, when I'm exacting my revenge in America for what it did to me and my kind, I get to exact it on you, too. What about that?
Well, he did say exactly that.
Yeah. So what about that, Larry?
Right. So I think that's part of this fear of incessant responsibility. And so my view is that you can, to a large extent, wash your hands, but that you have to actually do something a bit more dramatic with your distancing yourself from this than just literally washing your hands. And this, again, I go back to the ancient Greeks about this. I mean, the way you got rid of the pollution or the moral taint was by a ritual of purification, where you had to, maybe travel some distance and do some good deeds and so forth in order to show that you were a different kind of person than you were at the time that you did the act, or that you weren't that person that we thought you were. So I think there has to be something that you do. But the question about whether you can completely distance yourself from it is a tough one. And I don't think, and so I think this is in the spirit of what Gerald was saying a minute ago, I don't think you can completely distance yourself or completely wash your hands fully clean. But when we get down to those last little traces, I don't think that there's a whole lot that follows from that other than certain remote feelings on your part that may have some motivational force, but probably wouldn't have a strong motivational force.
Alex in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alex.
Thank you. I think it's a mistake to talk about the sins of our fathers as if what happened to black people is in the past. It's still going on. The seeds that were planted, the evil seeds that were planted, the dehumanization of black folk, especially in America, not to say anything about Native Americans, is still going on. The Bantustization of black Americans, the ghettoization of black Americans, the incarceration of black Americans still continues. And the taxpayer and the voter today is responsible for the condition of black folk. And this will continue. This will be the disaster, impending disaster, if not already. America will just be going down the sinkhole in the not too distant future, because incarceration and the police force and no amount of force, or no amount of incarceration is going to solve this problem. People are having children, and children having their children, exponential growth, and the welfare systems are lack thereof, and the lack of funding for education. You're making a lot of points.
They all resonate with me as being a bit of a pessimist. But let's go back to the first one, that using slavery as our paradigm case of sins of our fathers may be a little misleading in that this is a case where the sins continue.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Larry, briefly?
Well, I think that's the case that is easier in some ways than the one that we started with, because if it's continued, then we still have some kind of even active role to play. And then I don't think many people would feel that there is no responsibility at all. So, but then it becomes a question of whether it's the same thing going on, whether what happened with slavery is the same as what happens with the contemporary incarceration of large numbers of young black men. There may be a link between those two, but I'm not sure you even need to establish that, because the current case is enough, I would think, to get the responsibility claim going.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about moral taint and collective responsibility with Larry May from Vanderbilt University.
In our final segment, we'll continue to discuss collective responsibility and its impact on public policy. What, if anything, do the descendants of the perpetrators of past injustices owe to the descendants of the victims?
From reparations and affirmative action to Hawaiian independence and the right of return, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Who will pay reparations on my soul? An interesting question, given our subject today, moral taint and collective responsibility. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Larry May from Vanderbilt University, author of Sharing Responsibility. And we're asking, can we really be tainted by the sins of our fathers? And we've got some callers on the line. Lori from Mill Valley, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yes, thank you. You may have already touched on this, but there's a value, psychological value, I believe, and psychosocial value in bringing the taint forward historically or from past generations, because it contributes to our ability to make moral choices. It contributes to our moral development as humans to take into consideration what our forebears have done. And in addition, I think, you know, because we are what we are, we embody both bad choices, bad feelings, bad actions, as well as a need to morally develop. So that history has a positive, you know, a negative history of action can have a positive effect on our moral development in terms of the choices that we then make knowing that history.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm gonna ask Larry if that makes sense, Larry. Thanks for the question. What do you think, Larry?
I think it does make a lot of sense. I think Larry's onto something. That part of the problem with just taking a very narrow sort of snapshot view of what you're responsible for in terms of what you have actually done is that it doesn't allow for you to see all the interconnections that there are in your life and to make you grow by an appreciation for those. And I would take it in a slightly different direction as well, and that is that in the debates about these things in the international community at the moment, there's a close connection between reparations and reconciliation. And so at the end of an atrocity or a war, one of the questions is raised about who should pay reparations. But often that question is swamped by the question, what's it going to take for the sides to reconcile so that they can both achieve some kind of a just peace down the road? And I think it takes growth on both sides for that to happen. And it often means that both sides are going to have to give something up.
So let me ask a more general question, or that is, in America, there's a lot of respect for the idea of individualism, and it may be even kind of the official philosophy of America. But you certainly find individualists a person who's privileged is more likely to be an individualist than a person who's not, just is from my experience. So to what extent does your point of view undercut this philosophy of individualism?
Well, I suppose I try to undercut it to a certain extent. I still think that there's a lot to be said in favor of individualism, but I think that there should be a nice, healthy mix with a sort of sense of community that we all have benefited from and that we're all part of. So I suppose, in a sense, my view it sits somewhere between a strong individualism and a strong communitarian view. But I think that these things are more easily reconcilable than people normally think. And these are the kinds of cases we've been talking about today, where who out there didn't feel some pride when the U.S. made it beyond the first round in the World Cup? You know, it's this goes back to one of the earlier questions as well, where it seems like, this was, I think, Gerald's point, that somehow it's almost impossible to escape these connections to community. And so no matter how strongly an individualist society we are, I think that other dimension of it is there as well, and we can find just as many examples of it.
So, Larry, I'm not sure if you're going to disagree or agree with what I'm about to say, but I get the point, and the caller just now, Lori, I think she made an important point. I think there's a kind of, let's call it, heuristic value in narrating to ourselves the past and our connection to the past. But I still think we could just regard this from a point of view of justice. And the lottery deals certain cards. And sometimes the lottery isn't just a random thing. It's like your ancestors did this to my ancestors, and I happen to be born of these people and you. And if you think about it in terms of distributive justice, we don't really have to think of it in terms of reparations from X to Y or reparations from group X to group Y. Because it seems to me that whole dialectic is kind of politically fraught, because people say things that are not really helpful. I don't owe you anything. Well, no, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about distributive justice, fair schemas, right? It's not as though I'm trying to compensate you. I'm asking you to compensate me for something your ancestors did to my ancestors. I'm asking us to correct the unjust lottery, right? The lottery of life doesn't deal out its cards justly. So if we just think in terms of justice, isn't that enough? I don't see what the dialectic of reparations adds.
So I would make two quick points about this. One is, I don't think that justice is all that morality concerns. And so especially if you think of justice just in terms of distributive justice and don't think about it in terms of compensatory justice and a lot of other types of justice as well. But I think that there is more to morality, and this gets into this idea that Laurie had about the moral development part of morality that isn't just about my making sure that I'm not unjust to you. The second quick point that I'd make is that I don't think that we have to do this in terms, as I said a minute ago, of one individual against another. Here's an example that might work. I taught in Australia for a number of years, and you had a bit in your promo about the stolen generation and how Australia has been really sensitive to this. So when you would give a major lecture at Australia in their main auditorium, you would always have to wait for someone to stand up before you gave your talk and to admit that the Australian National University in Canberra, the capital, had stolen the land that this auditorium was on from the native peoples. And then there would be a kind of a moment of silence, and then it would be your time to give your talk. And this went on every single time a talk occurred in their main auditorium at the Australian National University. Now, that seems to me to be a really important part of a reparations program. No one was taking from someone else and giving to someone else, but there was a real, I think, important thing that happened here, and that the Native population felt very strongly about it, and I think that those of us who were participating as whites from the other side felt strongly about it as well.
And those Aussies have come a long way since the white Australia policy. John, you wanted to make it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is kind of directed at Ken and Larry, but Ken talks about this lottery and distributional justice. I think it's all fine, but, you know, that's not the system we have. I mean, we have a system where you do inherit property from your parents. You know, I inherited a little money from my father that allowed me to buy a cabin on a few acres up in the mountains, and that's really changed my life because it gives me a place to entertain my grandchildren. And my life would be quite different without that. But, I mean, that's the policy we have. We don't start over from scratch. We do benefit in lots of ways from the things that our parents and grandparents accumulated. And so within that context, I mean, if you put reparations within that context where we already got this intergenerational drift of benefits, I think it makes a certain amount of sense to think that, you know, take the Indians in the Black Hills or take the Native Americans that live on the two big Sioux reservations right above Nebraska and South Dakota. That's poverty-stricken, alcohol-ridden, economically destitute places, but a few miles to the west, there's the Black Hills with a robust economy. Shouldn't something be done about that?
What do you think, Larry?
Well, I certainly agree, and then the question is what? And I think that the way that Ken has forced the issue to make us think about taking from me to give to someone else highlights the central issue in that we're debating, and that is that can we come up with a policy that doesn't have that consequence, that doesn't take directly from one person and give to someone else? Well, and this is what our system of taxation as a very large public policy is supposed to do, is supposed to allow us to engage in all kinds of practices that the society itself stands behind, not just a single individual who happened to pay a minuscule part of those taxes.
Well, this is interesting stuff. So I want to give you a chance we were kind of discussing public policy right then and there. But I want to give you a chance to really make some public policy recommendations for your last moment. I don't know if you want to do that or not. I'm going to make you czar of the world for a day, and you're going to solve all these problems. What would be your major public policy recommendations here?
Well, in this respect, I do think that these reparations proposals often make a lot of sense, especially in the affirmative action domain. And so I'm very much in favor of this. But I do think that, again, on the other side, as it were, the problem is to figure out a scheme that doesn't disadvantage someone else so strongly as a result. And those things are really hard to do in our society. And that's why these problems have persisted. But it does seem that this goes back to, I think it was Alex's point earlier, and that is that these problems have persisted into the way that we act toward each other in the current generation. And insofar as they do, then I think there's a much stronger case to be made for reparations.
Well, this is really fascinating stuff, Larry. You know, there's so many issues I would really love to pick your brain about. I mean, both the Israelis and the Palestinians claim a right of return to the same land, and it's all about past issues, and all over the world there are these issues. I wish there was some silver bullet for me that I could take to people and say, this is how you should think about it, in order to make some progress on these thorny issues. Some last silver bullet?
I don't think in philosophy there are silver bullets.
That's right.
No. So I think you got the wrong guest on.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of cyanide pills, but no silver bullets.
Well, on that note, Larry, this has really been a fascinating discussion, and we have only touched the tip of the iceberg of this. This is a really deep topic, and I thank you for your work on it.
Thanks. It was fun.
Our guest has been Larry May. He's a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, author of Sharing Responsibility. So, John, you got any thoughts you want to share responsibility with
us? I think Larry got around to taxation at the end. I think that's a very interesting topic. A lot of people don't like to pay taxes. Romney says we have a duty not to pay any more taxes than we owe. I've never felt that way. I feel good when I pay my taxes, except insofar as America's using them for war and stuff like that. Taxes are a great way to spread the burden of dealing with collective guilt. I mean, it's not perfect, but you can by and large assume that high tax rates for the rich will impact those who benefited most from injustices in the past, and that generous social programs will benefit on average most people who haven't. I'm a great fan of taxation as a way to assuage my guilt.
I get you, and I get Larry's point, and I think the caller who talked about the kind of moral formation kind of thing, thinking about the past and our relation, is an important thing, but I just think that kind of dialectic is so fraught with the possibility for misunderstanding. I'd rather talk about transhistorical schemas of justice and just forms of taxation and not think of them in compensatory terms, because then people get confused. But you know what? This conversation continues unconfused at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from the man tainted by the sins of all of our fast-talking fathers, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, thanks to Adam and Eve, we live in a fallen world, even beyond Judeo-Christian traditions in an increasingly secular arena. Original sin still trickles down, flooding cultural practices. If our fathers sin, we pay for it. If we hang out with sinners, communities curdle. It's contagious. Sure, we're rugged individualists, but we are hobbled by influences, bad boyfriends, drunk teachers, weird things our families did that left us unprepared for life. If we're homeschooled to deny evolution, climate change, and women's sexuality, what do we do when we find somewhere all of these things are real? Individuals are shaped by history, by family, and we shape them right back. It's hard to escape. Hatfields and McCoys, Capulets and Montagues, Sunnis and Shias, Crips and Bloods, Protestants and Catholics. Only time can cure those wounds. Time offers both oblivion and solace. Take Abraham's nephew, Lot, one of the more curious figures in the Bible. In humanity's early days, he was looking for a place to lodge his flock. Lot, so the Bible says, pitched his tent towards Sodom. The land was good, but Sodom itself was a very, very, very wicked place. Still, he was doing so well, Lot moved to town. He was sitting at home when some angels in disguise stopped by, looking to see if there were any decent folks in Sodom. Some lurking Sodomites came to the door wanting to rape the angels, because that's how they roll in Sodom. Would Lot send them out, please? Lot said no, that would be rude. Would they care to rape his daughters instead? They're virgins. Somehow this behavior endeared Lot to the angels. They struck the Sodomites blind and told Lot to get his family out of town and don't look back. Well, Lot's wife did look back, turned into a pillar of salt. Sodom was destroyed, and Lot and his daughters moved into a cave. His two daughters apparently thought they were the last people on Earth and decided to have sex with Dad to repopulate. So they got him drunk on two consecutive nights and bore him two sons, who gave unto us the tribes of Moab and Ammon over the next few generations with their false gods, lust, and incest. These tribes caused all sorts of trouble for monotheism. Finally, Moabite Ruth came along, who rejected the beliefs of her ancestors, to become the great-grandmother of old King David. God liked that. So there you go. Whatever you were before can be swept away. That's the promise. Moab and Ammon are footnotes today. Bye-bye, bad influence. Moab was also a region conquered by early Egypt. The city of Moab in Utah was apparently named for this region. I don't know why. It has been a popular location for many movies, including Stagecoach, Thelma and Louise, and the latest Transformers movie, which I understand is turgid, bloated, and a surefire indicator that culture as we know it is doomed. The kids love it, of course. Their offspring will surely pay. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks for thinking too.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced they'd be making $70 million available to improve tribal housing conditions, including money for mold removal. To which the Native Americans presumably said, "Oh, finally! Okay, we are officially square."